For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Welcome, everyone. So, now we're going to begin the Megillas Esther. And the name says it all. Well, what does the name Esther mean? Her real name was Hadassah, nice Jewish name.
Hidden.
But hidden. The word Esther means hidden. There's a famous Gemara in Megillah which asks why we don't read the Hallel on Purim. And one of the answers given was that even after the miracle of Purim, everything wasn't good, meaning that we were still, the Beit HaMikdash wasn't rebuilt, and we were still servants of Ahasuerus. And yes, it's true, Haman didn't succeed in destroying us, but Esther was still stuck in the palace. And so it was a certain kind of hidden miracle. And this is really, when you think about it, it's the only Megillah that was written in the Gullus, in the exile. It was written in a time... when we lived in our land and there was a Beit HaMikdash standing, you could go witness miracles every day. You could go to the Beit HaMikdash and there were certain things that you could see. Now we live in a time where Hashem's hand is hidden. And we don't really... we see things, we see tragedies, we see terrorism. And where's Hashem? You know, it's a hidden... he's behind the scenes. We don't understand how he's working. And so the Purim message, there were a lot of things that were going on. Like we're going to see that Esther is taken to the palace. Nobody understood why that was. What was the reason for that? Why would this Jewish woman? Why she would be taken to Ahasuerus' palace? And it's so bizarre, like in a beauty contest. And she didn't even want to be in the contest. And she was taken. And then Haman, this Amaleki, this arch enemy of the Jewish people, he gets raised up and he gets powerful. And in the end, there's so many parts to the story. We're going to see that Mordechai was checking on Esther, and it happened to be he was a member of the Jewish court, the Sanhedrin. And in order to be a member of a Jewish court, there are many important Torah rules. One of them is that you shouldn't hear something through an interpreter. When something's said through an interpreter, you have to know the original language. In fact, they had a Rabbi Krohn was here. He was speaking yesterday at the Kollel. They dedicated the building to someone. And he said that somebody, an English person, married an American girl, and he wanted to say that she looked like $1 million, but he said, "You look like £1 million." And she didn't appreciate that. But in England, I guess they use pounds instead of dollars, but he was trying to be romantic or whatever. It just, but translation, it loses something in translation. And when you deal with a question of justice, you really need to hear a person firsthand. So the members of the court had to learn the languages of the Jews that lived in these various communities. So he happened to know some far-flung language that the two palace guards had no dream that Mordechai would know this language. Because he's a Jew. How would he know our native, tongue? And sure enough, he overheard them plotting against the king. And there were different parts of this story that if you took each one alone, maybe you understood it, maybe you didn't. But when you put it together... The idea came that Hashem guides the hand of history, that Hashem is behind everything. He works in a hidden way. And so the message of the Megillah, the word Esther, comes from the word hidden. And so that there's an idea that Hashem can be seen in hidden things. It's almost like, in The Wizard of Oz, you have the wizard is behind the curtain, you know, he's manipulating things behind. Hashem is like behind the scenes, so to speak. And so we see Hashem's hand in events, sometimes not as they occur, and sometimes much later. After they happen, we see Hashem's hidden hand. And so that would definitely be what the message of Purim would be. The other thing about Purim, the word Pur itself comes from the word lottery. And a lottery, it could be understood to be something that happens by mistake or that's random. And the idea of Purim is that even though events seem to happen randomly, they don't seem to be connected, that Hashem has a purpose in mind, that there's a reason why everything happens. Again, that has to do with the theme of Esther. And so we'll get into that, but you have to keep that in mind. It's a little harder in some of the Haftorahs and the books of the prophets. They tell it to you like it is. You know exactly what they're trying to say. Don't do this or don't do that, or you know, you're sinning, or Hashem is praised. Here the message is a little more hidden. And in fact, it's the only Megillah where Hashem's name isn't in the Megillah. You won't find Hashem's name in the Megillah at all. There is a tradition that when it says the king, it might be a reference to the king, even though the king here is Ahasuerus, but it's even the kings are subservient to the real king. You know, that's Hashem. But again, that goes with the theme of being hidden. Some of our Shabbos prayers, we ask the Hashem to reveal His kingdom. We're tired of living in a world. I don't know if that tired is the right word, but we live in a world where there are a lot of tragedies where people don't see Hashem. And we eventually hope for a time where we'll understand, where there won't be tragedies anymore, where there won't have to be a hidden hand, where Hashem can reveal Himself. And so that's a common theme of the of prayers of some of the hope for Mashiach. But let's just keep that in mind when we learn it, that we're trying to see the hidden hand of Hashem. We're trying to see the hidden message. And the nature of this book is that it's hidden. So it lends itself. In fact, one of the first things you'll see if you turn to page 18, if you have this one, is that there's a giant letter in the middle of verse 6. And the Megillah is full of these little puzzles like that. And when we get there, and shortly, you'll try to tell me why that's a giant letter. The ches in the first word on verse 6, where it says chur. You see that? That's written in the Megillah, like out of nowhere. It's like triple the size. Why would that... And we'll get there shortly, but I'm just pointing out that it's a mysterious Megillah, and there are things that are hidden. That's point number one, and again, that's understood from the name Esther. Point number two is the word Megillah in Yiddish has, when something is long, it's become, you say, the whole Megillah. It's like the Megillah is like a lot of details. It just doesn't get to the point. Like, it goes on and on and on and on and on, but unless you see the whole story, you might not connect the dots, the way things might not all come together. And so the word Megillah itself has come to mean the whole scroll. It's part of a whole story. There are a whole bunch of events, and you kind of wonder why it goes so much into this and into that, but when you put the whole thing together, when you see the whole Megillah, then all of a sudden it fits together. But that's commonly today when somebody gives you, you know, goes, oh, the whole Megillah, give them the whole Megillah. It's like give them the whole, you know, the whole story. One other thing, that Gemara that we mentioned in Megillah, which asks, you know, why we don't say Hallel on Purim. There's another view that we don't say Hallel. Hallel is the song where we thank Hashem. And when a person's life was in danger and it's no longer in danger and they've been saved, they should be very grateful. When somebody is worried that they're concerned that their life won't go on, or that they have a dreaded disease or a sickness and they're worried, it's like a huge cloud that hangs over them. But if they know that they've been cured or they've been healed, they're so thankful that they don't have to live every day worrying about that. So with Haman there in power and the decrees that he made, there was this huge cloud. Like, we were concerned that everything that we knew of would be over with, all of our families, all of our lives, all of our children. And when Haman was defeated, it was a time to say praise of Hashem. So the second opinion of the Gemara says that the Megillah itself is Hallel. Just being able to tell over the story is a form of praise of Hashem, saying over the story of Purim. And in fact, when they read it, you're not supposed to talk. You're supposed to hear every word, because it's only if you put everything together. And life has to be that way. Many times in life, if you look at just one segment, it's not. You don't get the whole picture. You really need to see the whole Megillah before you can pass judgment on things. So, okay, we'll begin with that. Vahibi Meya Hashverosh, and it was. This is one of the 24 books of Tanakh. Just like we have 24 hours, we have 24 books. And one of the rules it mentioned is the word Vayehi. Whenever it says "and it was," it means something sad. Because it doesn't need to say "and it was." Obviously it was. It was. Of course it was. But it means to say it was not good. Vayehi, and it was. It means to... And so if you take that and you look, you'll see in other places, you usually just have to look near that. If you ever see that word to begin with, it means that we're going to start with something bad. Vayehi, and it was, bimei Achashverosh, in the days of Achashverosh. We talked about the Megillah being hidden. One of the problems of the Megillah was that it had to be written during the reign of Achashverosh. It was written down when he was still king. And it was very dangerous to insult the king. Especially kings, the monarchs, today we look at them, and they seem to be strange creatures, strange people. They have all kinds of funny whims and funny habits, but it was very dangerous to insult a king, as Vashti discovered. You don't listen to the king, you could lose your life. Therefore, the sages, obviously, when they wrote the Megillah, couldn't write their true feelings about Achashverosh. We have a tradition that says in some ways he was as bad as Haman. We blame Haman for the decree to wipe out the Jews, but who do you think signed the decree? Who gave Haman the ring to do it? It was Achashverosh. And so in some ways he was equally bad, but we really can't say it, because he was the king. So Achashverosh, according to most people, was not a hero, was not a good person. Even though he agreed not to harm the Jewish people, he was really a villain. But we can't say, at that time, they couldn't say it too much because he was the king, and you had to, if you couldn't say something like that against the king. With his leadership, though, it was a very scary time because when you have a king who's a fool, one of the things that he does, when you think about it, it's amazing. He has a party for 180 days. We criticize Obama because he plays golf too much. Imagine if he had 180 days. I remember when I was a student and I was in Israel. In Israel, you can celebrate Purim for 2 days if you're lucky, because there are walled cities and there's unwalled cities. So you can celebrate Purim on the regular Purim, and then you can go to Jerusalem and celebrate Shushan Purim. I had such a good time on the first Purim that I was physically unable to celebrate, go to Yisrael. I don't know how you do it. If you really party strong, you're exhausted afterwards. if you put yourself, you put your whole self into, really having a good time, you can't do it for 180 days. How do you keep, what do you do from morning till evening for 180? The funny thing is for us, some people, if you have a 3-day yontif, they'll tell you it's torture. Now, I understand if you're, if you're the lady of the house and you have to serve the meals and prepare, and that's a lot of work. But you would think that the people that are sitting at those meals would be so thrilled and so happy to have these wonderful, by the time they get around to the second or third day, it's hard. We just can't do it. So some of it has to do with, we're not creative enough on some of our meals, and the meals are not a certain kind of meal where you have the right kind of family and the right kind of, every meal is an experience, people, it's a closeness and it's a, and unfortunately sometimes we're just, we see meals as a way to fill up the tank, you got to put some gas in to keep on going. And so the meal loses that. Some people do shorter meals and they do other things. But just trying to understand what occurred here, for 180 days he partied straight. So that gives you an idea of what kind of king he was. This was what he saw as, he was just being able to do that. It seems to be in the Middle East that they had a lot of monarchs like that, sometimes they had other people running the country, which was good because the king was busy partying all the time and doing all the, there's actually, a scandal now. This, I think it's Prince Andrew or whatever, one of the royals. I don't know why. People assumed that they were, you know, doing nice things, and they found out he was a little bit of a playboy. He was a little. I don't need to go there, but I'm just saying the kings. When you have a king that is interested in leading a life of parties and fooling around, there are serious issues that need to be dealt with in the country. There are people that are suffering. There's not enough food to go around. There's not enough medicine to go around. There's many different problems in all these kingdoms. And you have a king that's just thinking about having big parties and stuff like that. So that from the very beginning, this would be a difficult kind of government during the times of Ahasuerus. Now it starts out in an interesting way. First, it says, and it was during his time. And who is Ahasuerus? So to understand him, it tells us Hamolech Mehodu Vagkush. The word Hamolech means he made himself king. He was a self-made king. That was most of the kings were kings because their father was the king. He was a conqueror. He was a very aggressive person. He made himself a king of the various countries that were in existence at that time. From Hodu until Kush. Today Kush is commonly thought of as Ethiopia, but it's definitely a country in Africa. In Israel, they call the blacks Kushim, because the Ethiopians were called Kush, or, you know, I don't know if they still do, but for a long time, that if you hear them say the Kushim, that means it's like in Yiddish, like the Shvarta, the dark. But from Ethiopia, from Hodu until Kush, meant from Asia to Africa was like the whole world. So he was king from all of the various peoples, over 127 different kingdoms. Now, there's a very interesting science called the numbers game, where you examine numbers that are listed in the Bible, and you learn things from the numbers that are used. A lot of numbers in the Tanakh and in the Chumash, and there's a significance to all different numbers. We have certain numbers that have 13 and 10 and different numbers that have various meanings. So the Gemara mentions, it's actually a Medrash, this 127. Would anybody want to guess where that number comes up in the Chumash, the 127?
Was it Sarah?
That was Sarah. Very good. It happened to be Sarah lived to 127 years. That's the only other reference to this number given, is in reference to the age of Sarah. And the entire Chumash is, the Chumash itself has over 300,000 letters. You know, it's a big book. You know, so what is the significance of Sarah to this 127? So the Medrash says that Esther afterwards was the queen of a very powerful empire. And she did a lot of good. She had a husband who was not so good. She was able to accomplish many things for the Jewish people and for others. So what they do is they connect it, and they say that if Esther got to be queen over 127 countries, it was in the merit of her grandmother. That's a famous idea that sometimes we sometimes give ourselves too much credit, meaning that we shouldn't. Sometimes Hashem smiles on us in life and things are good, and we haven't necessarily earned it on our own, but people that came before us, we might have had a grandmother or a grandfather, a great grandmother, and she davened for her descendants. She davened for her grandchildren.
Who's her grandmother?
Sarah.
Esther is Sarah's grandmother.
Well, Sarah was the grandmother of the Jewish people, but she davened that her children, they had a tradition from Hashem told Abraham that I'm giving you the land of Israel, but you should know that your children won't be here forever. They'll go into exile. So she davened that her children would survive the exile, that they would survive the various enemies that they would have. And in order to survive somebody like Haman, they needed to have one of her descendants who would be Esther, who would rule over 127 kingdoms. I mean, technically, her prayers were for all of us, right? But Esther lived really for the sake of the Jewish. Hashem put her in that position to save the Jewish people. That was in the merit of Sarah, who who prayed for her descendants that they survive and that they overcome the, that they manage to survive the exile or manage to survive the future.
Not literally her grand.
It would have been about 700-800 about 400 years at least, 400 or 500 years. So, but I have no question about it that again, things that I've seen or there are many times you'll see that when somebody becomes observant, and it'd be one thing if they lived in an observant neighborhood and they were neighbors, their neighbor was a rabbi and they were in the school with rabbis and other people, then you could see how Judaism grabbed them, like what brought them to it. But sometimes it's because they had people that came before them who wanted their children to follow in their ways, and they were saddened that not every child was doing the right things, and they prayed that so sometimes there'll be somebody living in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden they feel a pull towards Judaism, and they find their way towards it, and that comes from the previous generations. It comes from their bubbies and their zadies, and it might even be further back. It might be closer, but I think that that's a common idea, that things happen because of not necessarily what we have. There's a bigger picture involved, and so they do note that the 127 came from Sarah. It's interesting. You don't. There may be other connections as well. It's just a curiosity that it uses that number. Yeah. Okay, verse 2. Vayamim mehem keshevas hamelech Achashverosh, and it was in those days. Now it uses the word. This word shevas is the same word as Shabbos. It means to relax or to be settled. On Shabbos, you're settled, you're relaxed, you're not working, when he was in the process of taking over these 127 kingdoms, there was a certain amount of warfare and intrigue and fighting, and it wasn't secure. But at a certain amount of time, he felt that he could rest, that his government was secure. And so it was in those days, Keshevas HaMelech, when he felt secure, when he felt he could rest, when he could, it could be like Shabbos, it was time to celebrate and sit down and relax. Akisei Mamluchasa, and it says on his place of governance, Asher B'Shushan Habira, and that place was in Shushan. Very interesting, because the there was something once called Bible criticism, and they actually taught it as a class, and the earlier Bible critics made fun of this, that there was a capital in Shushan, because there was no record of the Persian kings having a capital in Shushan. About 20 years ago, they found it. They found the capital. They have the ruins of that palace. There's a National Geographic that even has pictures about it. They found the palace of Achashverosh in Shushan, in the area that was... what happened was that he moved the capital city to the city that was his birthplace. You used to hear this about Saddam Hussein, that he had the city that was his hometown, you had this with Lenin too, with Stalin. That was where a person comes from is like his area of importance. So since he was the king and he was from Shushan, so he established Shushan should be the capital city. But it wasn't the ancient city that was the capital of all the Persian kings and emperors. He made it the place where he was going to be. That's actually what it's hinting to over here, that when he was established, he decided to make the seat of his government in a place called Shushan. The word Bira, it just means like the big city. That's the word, the Bira, is like the big city or the big... a little more than a village. It means like a big, a big area. It's called Abira, Shushan Abira. So, now, when was it? Bishnas Shal, it was the third year in his kingdom. Osei Mishte Lekosar. So, what he wanted to do was to have a party. This party would be his way of showing everybody. Now, what was he trying to show? Some people say he wanted to show off his wealth. He wanted to... other people say that he thought that by having this party they would like him. I read that the czars used to have big parties at their coronations, and they would have big parties where they invite all their subjects to come and toast to the health of the king, that was a way of honoring a king, was having like a really big big feast or a big party. So in the third year of his reign, he made this mishta, and he invited all of his officers, all of his servants. Now, you want to invite the army because you want them to be on your side. They're the kind of people that you want to have to be happy, is the soldiers. They're the ones who guarantee the strength of the government. So he invited these various armies. There were two, the Persians and the Medes. It's interesting. I mean, even today, like if you look in those countries in the Middle East, they had all these different nationalities. You know, you have the Shittites and the Shias and these just different groups that are there, but they're in the same countries, and they go back from ancient times between the Persians and the Medes. They go back to the Shias and the. In other words, when these various sects that are there, they've been there since ancient times. These various clans and various groups, Hapartumim, and these were different Bisaria Medinas, and all the various representatives of these various groups came to this party. Now, what was the purpose of this party? Now, there's a debate here about why do we need to know this? Some people really miss this whole thing. Like, why don't we just get, there was this guy named Haman, and he caused a lot of trouble, and they told Esther, and she fixed the problem. Like, let's get to the point. What do we need to know about the whole party? So, this too is discussed in the Gemara. That one of the big advantages of this Megillah is that there's a whole Gemara that's devoted entirely to explaining the Megillah. The Gemara and Megillah goes through the Megillah Esther. So we have a lot more background information on this than we do some of the other Megillah, because we have the Gemara spend a lot of time on it. But why is it going into the party? Like, what do we, this party seems to... So we've already kind of answered one question by saying that the event in the party... led to Vashti getting executed. And Vashti getting executed led him to get a different queen who wouldn't have the kind of background and the baggage that Vashti had. In other words, we're going to see Vashti, one of the reasons that she got killed was that she lorded over her husband, and she was of royal birth and he wasn't. And so therefore... he wanted a queen who was not from the royal family. He wasn't looking for Yichus. He wasn't looking for the queen that was... He was looking for a queen, you know... So because of the events that are put into place through this party, Esther is chosen, and eventually the Jewish people is saved. And so at the time of the party, nobody knew what the purpose of the party was, but there was an idea that Hashem was already preparing the way. Before he brought about the danger of Haman, he already brought about the salvation, a way to put Esther in the palace to solve the problem. That would be one idea. Another idea, we'll see that Purim is celebrated at parties, by having parties, because that's when with the events of Purim happened at these parties. You kind of, you know, when you're celebrating on Purim, you kind of imagine what was going on at Haman's party, what was going on at Achashverosh's party, what was it, because these events all happened at parties. There's a third view, I guess this would be the Kashrus view, was that when you ask Hashem saved us from being in trouble and from being destroyed, so you may wonder, why were we put in that danger to begin with? How can we thank Hashem for saving us? Why do we deserve to be destroyed? That we should thank him for saving us. And the answer is, we went to this big non-kosher party. It looked really bad for us. And so then Hashem decreed, well, that's what you want to do in life. You want to just become like the Gentiles and go to their parties. So what do I need a Jewish people for? And then he brought Haman. And so it comes out that this party was really the catalyst for this was the mistake that we made. Now, we're going to see a debate when we see the words. Some people say that they had black kosher food at this party, that they provided, you know, that we're going to see that they provided whatever you wanted. That was part of the party. Some people say the Jews could order kosher if they wanted, you know, at this party. So then the question is, if it was, you know, AKC, whatever, you could have whatever you want. So then what did they do wrong by going to the party? And then the answer is going to be, just because the food is kosher doesn't mean the entertainment is kosher. That's the, in other words, we'll see what the symbolism of the party was. So let's see.
Question. Yeah. So Esther was brought in after this party. Of the party and because the Jewish people were partaking in it, mm-hmm. then Esther was like sacrificed to be in this.
Her whole life was sacrificed.
Her whole life was sacrificed.
Right. Well, that's true. That's true. I mean, the truth is that, many people they give, you know, they people that give their lives for others or work on behalf of others, you know, they have things that they could have done if they were only in it for themselves, so to speak. But she, most people, they at least have their families, they have their children, they have, they can go to their synagogue. I mean, Esther really lived in the palace of this, you know, this mass murderer, you know, this guy that liked to party. He was like the opposite of somebody she would have wanted to be with. According to some people, that she had a child through him, but she couldn't raise him. And that was also common with the royals. They didn't let the queens raise. They would raise the kids. They hired people to. And so that would have been very painful to her to have a child and then have the child raised in idolatry and raised in the ways of the emperor. And that's also part of the hiddenness of Esther. And one view why we don't say hallow, because we kind of feel for Esther. The only thing is, she put her stock in the Jewish people. In other words, it's true that she didn't have any biological children, but we're her children. We're here because of Esther. We're, you know, the whole Jewish people was saved because of her. It started by going to the party. That was the mistake. Verse 4. Now, what was he trying to do with his party? Baharosa Osher Kavod Ma. He wanted to show off his wealth. I guess I've never had real wealth personally that I understood why people like to show it off. I mean, I suppose if I had wealth, maybe I would want to put it out there and let it. I don't understand it, is what I'm saying. I don't personally relate to it. But they say if you have wealth, you like to show it off. There's something that to that. There's a famous book by a sage that lived 100 years ago, and he claimed that the pogroms came because the Jews like to show off their wealth. I've even heard that in the wealthier communities, that there are people, there's some people feel that in the exile that we're supposed to be modest, we're not supposed to like show it all off. And there are communities where that is an issue. I don't think it's an Atlanta thing per se. But there are, they do say, like, sometimes people feel a need to, like, they'll show off at, like, they want to outdo the other. They want to have a fancier bar mitzvah or a fancier wedding than, you know, well, the other guy did it this way. I'm going to do even more because I got to, you don't see that as much. But you used to see it, or it still exists. I'm just saying I personally don't see it so much. New York? That's where they. I mean, people go into debt because they want to show up. They use the finest and the best, and they import the flowers from wherever. And they got they drive the nicest car. And the this was Achashverosh. He wanted to show off his wealth, and he had a lot of wealth, and he wanted to show it all off. And this was that's what he was going to do at the party. Now, usually you could show off your wealth pretty quickly. It gives you an idea of how wealthy it was that he like brought out different treasures every day. These were like trophies, different trophies he wanted to show. You even read about it with the people, they take wives as trophies. They call it a trophy wife. They would marry a woman because they want to show off that they have a pretty, and most of the time those marriages don't work very well, but it exists, such an idea that there are people that like to me it's just so shallow. Like, I feel bad for Achashverosh. He was like so, He had such low self-esteem, like if you could analyze him today, you know, like he's got if I show all my wealth, they're going to like me and they're going to say, you're a really great guy. Look at that, all the gold. And so like, you know, but that exists. There are people that feel a need to show it all off. So that's what he wanted to do. He's going to show it all off to everybody. And it's going to be for many days. Shmonim umeyas yom, 180 days, which again is a long time for a party. Verse 5. Now, after the big party, he had a small party, an even more expensive party. And that was part of the, you know, that was like the, I think what they do now, like, even in the United States, they have an inaugural when they have a new, they have like a week of festivities, and then they have the final ball, or those are all from the traditions that they used to have with the monarchs, where they would have they'd have a series of balls and of events leading to the inaugural. So it was at the end of these days, Asa HaMelech L'Kola Amenus, he made a party just for the people in Shushan, his capital city. because these were the residents, people that he would run across. Now, in the previous party, only the important officials were invited. In this party, he invited Limigoto Vadkatan, from young and old, even the simple people. Mr. Shivas Yamin, this was a seven-day party, and he had the party in an unusual location. He had it in the royal palace. I think they have this in France. They have royal gardens. The royals would plant special gardens where they'd have the most beautiful flowers and the most beautiful... They're the ones who could afford to do this, like very fancy. And so part of his showing off was allowing the commoners to come into his royal gardens. So he let them come into Ginas Beis in Hamelech. They got to see the king's royal gardens. That's where they had the party. Now we get to that big ches. We're going to see different tapestries in different colors. Why should that ches be so large? So does anybody know what the ches means in Hebrew? Ches? Ches is the letter 8. In other words, every Hebrew letter has a numerical value. Ches would be 8. And in the times of the temple standing, the clothing of the Kohen Gadol was known as the 8. Because a regular Kohen had 4 garments, and the Kohen Gadol had 8 garments. And he had like a gold crown that he wore that said "Holy to Hashem," and they had special tzitzis with purple wool and different colored garments and gold strings. And part of the clothing of the Kohen Gadol was very beautiful clothing, very beautiful. It was part of the effect of the service of Hashem was they wore these garments. In fact, in the Gemara, they talk about there was a non-Jew who was so impressed with the clothing of the Kohanim that he wanted to convert to become a Kohen. Because he was just, wow, those are really nice, garments you got. So one of the sages said, get out of here. There's no way you'll be a Kohen. That was Shammai. And Hillel said, you got to come to school and learn. And then by the time he got to the chapter that in order to be a Kohen, you got to be the son of Aaron, he was already hooked. They said that Hillel saw that it wasn't just the clothing that impressed him, it was the idea of serving Hashem. And so he thought, this person is so sincere, he wants to serve Hashem. You know what, let him learn a little bit. Let's see, maybe he'll be a good conversion candidate. And Hillel was right. But what impressed the non-Jew initially was the clothing. There was something about the clothing that the Kohanim wore. There was very special clothing. Now, clothing is very interesting because the Purim story has a lot to do with clothing. That's why we wear costumes on Purim. And we're going to see about the wearing special clothing. That's also part of the Purim theme. But the tradition has it that when they conquered the temple, there were a lot of very special vessels that they had. And we know from the description of the times of King Solomon, they didn't just use gold in the temple. They melted down hundreds of gold to get the finest gold. It wasn't just the plain gold. It was the purest of the pure. And the silver was the most sparkling of it. It was the best of the best. For the temple, they spared no expense. And the clothing was the finest of it. It's not things that commoners typically see. So when they sacked the temple, they had these things, and they were taken to Bavel. Now, the previous king, before Achashverosh, at one time decided to make use of the temple vessels. And what happened was he lost his kingdom that night. That's the famous handwriting on the wall. And it was a sign that he should not have taken them out, that it was he angered the God of the Jews. And these people were very superstitious. And what happened was that all of the Gentile monarchs knew that the Jews had a tradition that after 70 years, we would come back and we would break free from the exile. And see, we're used to the Jews being like very modest, very simple people. Jews were great fighters in ancient times, and the Gentiles, they were a great, mighty country. They were known for their brilliance. They were known for, you know, we're just used to being so used to the, you know, the anti-Semitism and the Christians and being humble, and we don't realize that, you know, we're from a very proud and great and mighty nation, and they were afraid of us. And he was afraid that he didn't want to anger the God of the Jews, but he decided that after 3 years, that the 70 years had come and gone, and nothing happened. And so therefore now it was safe for him to bring out the treasures of the temple at this party. And that would explain why it was so bad that the Jews went to this party, because here were the things that were sacked from the temple. The most sacred items were being used at this drunken orgy by the king, and they were participating. And some people say he did that deliberately, because if he could get the Jews to come celebrate their, you know, their downfall, that was a sign that they were never going to get their independence again. We're going to see later that when he is in a good mood and he promises he'll do to Esther whatever he wants, he said, I'll give you whatever you want up to half the kingdom. So if you measure the 127 countries, half the kingdom was the temple, because the Jews were pestering him to let him rebuild the temple, and he said, I'll let you do anything, but he was convinced that if the Jews found some way to rebuild the temple, they would rebel against him. But at this party, he came out with the ches, he came out with the 8 garments. So they said that he was wearing one, and Vashti was wearing the other, the high priest's, the breastplate. You can imagine of the 12, you know, the jewels, the finest jewels were on the breastplate of each one, was, you know, surrounded by gold. They came out of the party wearing these things. And we're going to see, to some extent, Hashem did get angry, and that's why he put into process his downfall, or the replacing of Vashti. But some people say that's why this ches is enlarged over here, the 8. 8 also stands for supernatural, because 7 are the days of the week, are the days of nature. The world was created in 7 days, and 8 is above nature. That's why Hanukkah is 8. That's why a bris milah is 8. 8 always symbolizes supernatural. And over here, when the Jewish people went to this party, and when a Jew acts like a non-Jew, there's no reason for history to be different for him. In other words, if we're just a goy that likes matzah balls, you know, or a goy that has a funny sense of humor or whatever it is, so the world has no purpose. There's no reason for us to exist. We're descendants from Abraham. We're people that care about others and love other peoples and want to make the world a better place and are dedicated to, you know, seeking justice and righteousness. And if a person is just interested in going to parties and being a good Gentile, there's no reason to have a Jewish people. And so the danger was that Ches is this above nature, that Hashem wanted to bring about the salvation of the Jewish people from these events before they happened. So he comes out with these different garments, chur, karpas, chelis. These are various colors. The chelis is the blue that was used on the tzitzis, was the chelis. And also, again, these are garments, different colors. It's interesting, today we take this for granted. Even if you're poor, you can buy various colored garments without any problem. In ancient society, color was very expensive. They didn't have the dyes that we do. So only very wealthy people could afford to have colored garments. It was like a big thing to have various colors, or only the royalty or the nobles. Otherwise, you know, you had your sheep's wool, they didn't have the plants or the coloring to dye it. And so at this party, he showed off his colors. These were the various colors that... In many ways, we're richer than the richest people in other, you know, in other times. When you think about it, you know, like the amount of clothing we have, nobody had the amount of color, the amount of variety of. We have foods in all seasons, you know, like nobody had oranges in the middle of the winter, or the, you know, like we do, or the. There's so many luxuries that we have that they just never existed. You know, we could come inside and it could be warm, you know, or just other things. We have light inside. That, you know, they used to have candlelight. Candlelight was pretty hard to read by candlelight, you know. So we have so many things that we're, like, so lucky, fortunate to have these things exist in our times. Even restrooms, you know, the kings didn't have restrooms like we had, you know. Even the wealthiest people didn't have. But we, you know, we just take for granted. Of course we have it. That's the way it is.
Karpas. Well, what's the connection with the...
That sounds like Pesach, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's some kind of colored garment. I'm not sure if I...
Where is that
green?
But I don't know. I didn't have a chance to see if they use that as the. It's the same word, but yeah, I don't know. The various colors, Vargama and Aglile Kesef, and they had silver, Vama marble, Mitosav, Kesef, and silver, Aritzis Bat, Vishesh. These are very. Talks about Ankh. I'm not even sure what Ankh is. It's kind of stone, I guess.
Sort of like marble.
Onyx.
Is it pronounced onyx?
Onyx. Oh. It's a black gem.
Is it a black gem? The,
I have it.
Oh, okay. Just all kinds of gems, and again, it was very impressive. And then again, if you listen to the Megillah, it's very interesting because the Megillah has its own tune. And in a few places in the Megillah, it switches to the tune of Eicha. Eicha is the song of the destruction of the temple, of the morning song. And in the next verse, where it says, and he gave to drink with gold vessels, so right over here, it switches. If you ever listen to the Megillah, it switches to the Eicha tune, because he brought out the cups from the temple. The temple had a lot of different cups for things. And he brought out the gold cups from different kinds of cups that were brought out. The Yain Malchus, and he brought out king wine, royal wine. Now, only a king could afford like the certain types of wine because it had to be aged. And he brought out like very good, very wealthy types of wine that people had never had such fancy wines. And normally, people are used to having a limited amount. When things are expensive, you can't have as much as you want. But this was Rav Kayana Malach. There was a wine, and there was no limits. It was like an unlimited bar. You could have as much as you wanted to drink. So you can imagine how drunk the people got at this kind of party, like where you had all this wealth and all this opulence, and it was just like only a king could afford. Now, sometimes there was a different problem. They bring this down. It's interesting that they used to force people to drink the whole cup. This was a Persian custom, like the... I mean, the truth is, that it wasn't that long ago when we grew up that you had to eat everything on your plate. You know, that was like the... So they used to, you know, they had... If they poured you, you know, in the cup, and sometimes if you tasted a wine that you didn't have, you didn't like it. Like, many times you'll do that. You'll taste a drink you've never had, you don't like. But they would force them to drink it once they gave it to you, because they weren't going to waste it. So, but then you don't really enjoy yourself if you have to drink the whole cup of this nasty, you know, wine that was it. Sometimes when you age wine, it has to age just right. Sometimes when you age it, it goes bad. It has to, aging means to ferment it. And so there's a certain kind of fermentation that it tastes good. And then there's other fermentations where it's really nasty. If you have to, they call that the kiddish surprise. Sometimes you'll make kiddish and you're expecting this really good wine, and it just doesn't have that good taste. And sometimes you have to pretend, oh, it really does taste like it. And other times it's just has gone bad because it isn't fermented right, it hasn't been stored right, or it has a sometimes wines have been here for years. We have this year is a sabbatical year in Israel. And the wine that's going to come out next year is not supposed to be farmed because it's a sabbatical year. And so it doesn't have the regular kosher mark. It has a mark that says the land was sold to Arabs, and a very questionable kind of thing that we're really not supposed to use. We still have, I've seen in Atlanta markets wine from the last 7 years ago. The last Shemitah. I just say the wine, especially sometimes kosher wine, stays around for a lot of, you know, religious people won't buy it because it doesn't have the regular kosher mark. So what happens is it kind of stays here until somebody who's not familiar with the Hebrew words buys it by mistake. But you could, we took it out of Kroger and Publix, and what happened, it shows up in Whole Foods where we don't have a kosher department, you know, or the someone gives them a good deal on some kosher wine, or the... But it's from the last... I'm just pointing out, you can have sometimes wine. I once saw a good deal on some wine in one of the supermarkets, and I bought it, and it was bad. It's just old. Sometimes if it's you buy the wrong wine, it's old. And you know, I'm just saying, be careful when you buy wine. Make sure it's good. But if you had to drink the whole cup and it wasn't good, it would not be pleasant. But one of the rules was that the wealth was such that they didn't force you to drink it. Even if you ordered it, they didn't say, like sometimes you order the the food, and then if you decide you don't like it, you can't say, oh, I changed my mind, I'll take the other dish. Well, one second, they don't want it because someone's got to pay for that. This kind of banquet was such an onus. You could do whatever you wanted. If you wanted to dump the wine, you dump the wine. Ki ken yisrael melech. This was the king. Now, the irony of this banquet was really something. We're almost done here. The irony of the banquet was he was doing everything to show off how great he was and how powerful he was, and in the end, he's going to look like a fool. Hashem had different plans, but he went out of his way. Oh, yes, whatever you want. I'll korah basically. Everybody can have what they want to do the will of each person. We'll stop here with verse 9.
Thank you.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.